This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, an effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally, and it's so effective it works for 9 in 10 people. The Zona Plus is a high-tech smart device that guides you through a patented therapy that's personalized to your unique physiology. To find out more, go to tryzona.com or call toll-free 888-408-6141. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, you can get $50 off and free shipping. Just use the coupon code Hoffman at checkout at tryzona.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's my favorite time of the week, actually, because I really enjoy these sessions where I answer your listener questions. Questions come to us via radio program at AOL.com. And, of course, as usual, I've got the capable assistance of Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. Always a setup for a great conversation about medicine, health, and nutrition. How you doing?
Okay. Thanks, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Good. Yeah, I think we've really lit up our audience with some of these discussions that we've had about topics that are of general interest. And, you know, when you listen to this particular segment, unlike some of the other segments that have a subject matter assigned to them, you never know what's going to come up. And it may be very germane to you, your predicament, or to that of a friend or a loved one. So, before we get into questions, by the way, radio program at AOL.com is the destination for questions. And Layla, we're getting a lot of questions, aren't we? And people are
responding. We are. So people, hang in there. We're maybe, a month, 6 weeks behind,
really?
So to speak. Not behind, but, you know, if you send us a question today, you may not hear the answer for about 6 weeks.
Okay. And that way we can entrap people into listening. You know, it's kind of like you're going to be on TV on the evening news. But you'll have to watch over the next 3 weeks, every night, to see every minute.
Well, you know, it's like they don't tell us the weather until the very end or something.
Right.
More on that after this break.
Right after this, yeah, we have a devastating cataclysmic hurricane. More at 11.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Right. So. There was an interesting article about tree nut allergy and that avoiding all tree nuts may not be necessary. Generally, when people are diagnosed with an allergy to tree nuts meaning anything but peanuts. They can be Brazil nuts, almonds, hazelnuts, filberts, walnuts. What have I left out? You know, any of those nuts that we're talking about, macadamia nuts, for example. Just because you're allergic to one, there's no longer, or they're saying we don't have to presume that you're allergic to the rest of them. Mm-hmm. And that, because a lot of people, more than half, the researchers say that more than half of patients who test positive for tree nut allergies based on blood tests or those skin prick tests, which I've had a lifetime ago, they experience no reaction to nuts when consumed.
Yeah. Well, you know, so the practical implication of that is, you know, first of all, nut allergy can be devastating. I mean, we've heard the story of the of the kiss of death. You know, literally, you know, the girl kisses her boyfriend, unbeknownst to the boy, or maybe deliberately so. We don't know. The boy has ingested, a bag of Planters peanuts, and there's just this faint residue, maybe a few molecules of peanut antigen in his mouth or on his lips. And that's transferred to the victim, and the victim goes in anaphylactic shock, and before nobody has an EpiPen or it's too late, the EMTs arrive too late, and the person has died of respiratory arrest. So so this is a big deal, and I think when people are found to have some sort of allergy to one or another nuts or peanuts, which actually aren't nuts. I mean, they're quite different from a plant species
peanuts
standpoint.
Peanuts are legumes. Yeah.
They're legumes. They're roasted legumes. So there's, you know, you're allergic to peanuts, although it's not a nut. It's not entirely certain that you're allergic to almonds or walnuts, for example, which are different.
Yeah.
But once, you know, there's such a scary prospect that you know, people just avoid nuts like the plague. So, mm-hmm. so let's say hypothetically, you know, you're not sure if you have a nut allergy. So you go to the doctor and the doctor does a blood test or the doctor does a skin test and reassures you that, you know, your entire lifetime, you thought you had a peanut allergy, maybe had some minor reaction once. And then, it is found that you have, a negative test. So the doctor mm-hmm. then reassures you, tells you that, there's a negative test and tells you, go ahead, you know, knock yourself out, eat peanuts, eat almonds, walnuts, hazelnuts.
Eat some peanut butter.
Right.
Sure.
And you say, no way. I'm not yeah. going to take my life. You know, thank you for the reassurance. I think I'll still stay away. So what do you do in that
right.
predicament? I think the workaround for that, you know, especially if there's a high suspicion for an allergic reaction, is mm-hmm. to, under a doctor's supervision, with proper emergency resuscitation equipment in an allergist's office, is to mm-hmm. imbibe a tiny amount of the nut and see, you know, be observed
right.
for you know, half an hour or an hour or more, and you know, sit there, read a magazine, see if you have a reaction, and if you don't, great. And if you do, well, then the test the test gave you a false reassurance.
Right.
But so. Is the converse also true? Is that, say, you have an allergy test that shows a reaction, mm-hmm. Then you may not, in practice, in real life, have a reaction. Is that correct?
Right. Absolutely.
Okay. So there's a disconnect with these allergy tests.
There is a disconnect, and that the gold standard may be an oral food challenge.
Yes.
Many people are coming back positive on certain things, but they don't have an actual reaction when they eat the mm-hmm. food, mm-hmm. when they eat the nut.
And
therefore.
Know, and, you know, we yeah. at the Hoffman Center, we've been getting away a little bit from allergy testing,
mm-hmm.
you know, partially because the allergy test we preferred in this wonderful regulatory state of New York.
The police state of New York?
Yes. They have seen fit to eliminate IgG RAST as a test which clinicians can perform. And so the IgE RAST, we find it's only useful for foods where it's pretty obvious you're going to have a reaction. And then
right.
the study even suggests that the IgE RAST may be wrong and may show up false positive. Conversely, mm-hmm. possibly a false negative. Usually not a false negative, but usually a false positive, you know, some reactivity
yeah.
where the person, from a practical standpoint, doesn't have any difficulty with that.
Yeah. I mean, for example, if a patient comes in and they're showing positive on various food allergy tests, blood tests or skin prick tests, and they tell me, or they come back negative for all of these things, and they say, oh, no, when I eat almonds, my lips swell up and I get an itching and a burning. You know, I tell them, don't eat almonds. It
yeah.
doesn't matter
yeah.
what
you,
the test said.
You perform the test.
Ultimately, it's the patient's presentation.
Right. Where the rubber meets the road. It's the reality check.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right.
And then what about the generalizability of nut allergies from across species? That isn't necessarily the case, although it can be the case, correct?
Right. It can be the case, but it's not necessarily the case. For example, the person with the almond allergy, they do fine with walnuts and macadamia nuts, and they can eat peanut butter. And all of that, but it's just the almonds.
And the new finding is that with kids, I mean, they used to say, you know, kids, especially from an allergic family, you got to stay mm-hmm. away from these things, you know, put the kid on a strict elimination diet, don't even get him near peanuts. And now it turns out that there's a critical window, I believe that's
yeah.
from, 3 to 9 months, something along those lines, where
yeah.
you want to feed the kid, but it's kind of scary.
Yeah.
In the case of, you know, very sensitive kid,
I can imagine the trepidation of the mother in doing that at all.
Take
right.
Take the kid
right.
to the pediatric allergist and then have the test administered. I know that with a young kid in my family, you know, there was a great deal of consternation about that, but they're deliberately feeding him a little bit of peanut during, he's now 16 months. So during that window where he was, his immune system was forming, you know, that mm-hmm. was a small amount of administration of a variety of things is probably a good idea.
Right, right. Yeah. And I know there are still some schools that don't allow children to bring any nuts to mm-hmm. school. And aren't peanuts, you know, the little bag of peanuts they give you on the airplane? I think that's been
you know something?
Outlawed because of the peanut dust.
I was on a plane. I came back from a meeting of the Alliance for Natural Health in Atlanta, and mm-hmm. they said, do you want some pretzels or nuts? And I said, nuts? What kind of nuts? And they said, peanuts. So I said, okay. Huh. You know, they handed me a bag of peanuts, but they were these sugar-coated, like, beer nuts. So, so I don't know. Maybe they're so sealed up in the sugar coating. That, you know, I didn't eat them. I had my own.
Right.
I had my own, like, natural bar with macadamia nuts.
There you go.
You know, I was in that one of those food deserts where there was no food available. But you know, mm-hmm. I guess they see fit to serving peanuts again, but maybe in that form where they're literally sealed in coating.
In that coating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
Whatever.
That would keep any peanut dust, like from the skins of the peanut, from kind of, you know, becoming airborne. Interesting.
Okay. So let's get to questions.
Okay. We've got a question here from Susan from Montana. Okay. She actually sent us this article about titanium dioxide, mm-hmm. that it may interfere in digestive processes. Mm. And she writes, another cause of gut dysfunction. This is in so many products, toothpaste, supplements, things you don't even think of. Mm-hmm.
It's a whitener.
It's a whitener. Exactly.
Yeah. It imparts a really nice white color to products.
Exactly. It's used in things like, the powder on the donuts that you find, the white color, or skin
milk. I didn't know that. There's titanium dioxide on the donuts?
There may be.
I'm going to stop eating those sugar donuts.
We've got to stop eating those donuts.
I just get to the office and there's a big tray of those, and I just eat, you know, three or four before I, you know, even see a patient. No, I'm kidding. Kidding.
I was just going to say, where are those donuts?
We hide them from
you. Let me give some. The thing about titanium dioxide, it's classified as a low microparticle. Really, the danger more than anything is that maybe the short-term exposure to nanoparticles of titanium dioxide.
Well, those are in sunscreen.
Yeah.
And especially when you spray the sunscreen, you can get these particles into your lungs.
Inhale it.
Yeah. There have been some studies that suggest, although the concern is if you apply it to your skin, can it penetrate the skin? Some studies, and, you know, maybe those are studies that are falsely reassuring, suggests that the particles are sufficiently large so that they don't pass through the skin barrier into the systemic circulation.
Right.
But
right.
even the nano,
right.
nano means very tiny. This comes back to something we've been talking about for a long time, especially with our patients who have ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Mm-hmm. They already have injured intestinal walls where there are ulcerations and inflammation. And if you look at titanium dioxide particles under the microscope, they look like little tiny shards of glass.
Dagger-like.
Yeah, they're very pointy and sharp. And so maybe an ordinary person with a gut wall that's intact will be okay. But certainly for patients who have any form of inflammatory bowel disease or maybe bad leaky gut syndrome, we're going to say stay away from those things. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I do even counsel our patients with inflammatory bowel disease to be careful of these microparticles. Besides titanium dioxide, aluminosilicates, annotase, calcium phosphate, these may be in toothpastes and things. So I tell them to avoid those.
And
I have a little bit of bad news here. Titanium dioxide can enter the digestive system through foods such as chocolate, where it's used to give it a smooth texture.
I'm not sure that that's going to be.
That's not going to be in all chocolate.
In the dark, ultra dark chocolate, because I would imagine that would be more in a white chocolate, no? Where they want that white color.
But more like in an instant beverage, hot chocolate or something like that.
Yes.
You're going to find it there, possibly in soft drinks.
Yeah.
in processed sauces. Spices with anti-caking agents may contain titanium dioxide. That's also a gluten source, too, anti-caking agents.
Right, where they put literally flour or starch in there. Yeah. Okay.
Other places where we find titanium dioxide, confectionery products, icing, sugar. In cereals, we can find it in whole grain flour or bread or refined flour.
I imagine poor quality cereals. Supplements, too.
Right. Yeah, poor quality supplements.
Medications, some medications, perhaps.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Definitely tea and coffee whiteners like non-dairy creamer, flavored milk products, processed cheeses, ready-made foods like frozen foods and TV dinners, and egg beaters. I tell everyone to stay away from egg beaters anyway.
Stop with
all that
egg
is
beaters.
Vegetable oil and salt.
I mean, you take something that's you know, it's like, how do you take something that's so... such a balanced source of nutrition, so great, and then you knock it off, and you know, with a chemically laden synthetic thing, and you know, if you gave cavemen, 25,000 years ago, egg beaters, the human race would be extinct.
Probably, yeah. Well, fat phobia still exists to some degree, unfortunately.
Yeah, or cholesterol phobia, because that's why, you know, the
cholesterol phobia.
They thought the egg yolk was responsible for all manner of ills. Okay, moving right along. What else we got?
Yeah, moving right along. We've got an email from Michelle. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I love your podcast, and I'm a longtime listener to your wonderful programs. I'm wondering, can I take strontium in the morning 1 hour before I take Westroid for hypothyroidism, as I can't take strontium before bedtime due to other supplements that I take at that time?
So what's your take on
that? Dr. Hoffman? Yeah, I think I would say no. I kind of like to classify strontium a little bit with some of the other minerals that may interfere with thyroid replacement, like Westroid. The other minerals are iron, magnesium, and calcium. So, Michelle, what you might want to do is take strontium sometime in the middle of the day, maybe between lunch and dinner, as long as it's farther away from calcium, if you're taking your calcium at night. And she says she's taking other supplements at night. I'm presuming that it's calcium and maybe some magnesium and some other things that might interfere.
I had a reminder.
What do you think, Dr. Hoffman?
No, I was going to say, you know, I was going to be more lenient than you, but I think you're probably right. In an abundance of caution, we don't want to take a mineral that is in some ways similar to calcium. You know, strontium is in the same column in the periodic table as calcium, and therefore it might have you know, some of the same properties as calcium in terms of interfering with thyroid medication, potentially.
Yeah.
So, you know, strontium, wonderful agent for enhancing bone density. I think it's safe. It certainly has been effective for many of our patients at the Hoffman Center over the years, and many listeners have used it and reported phenomenal results using strontium.
Yes. And we like it specifically for full-blown osteoporosis, right? Not osteopenia. Yeah.
Exactly. It's not for you know, somebody just routinely supplementing to prevent osteoporosis. I think when you use strontium, it is natural, but you're using it at what we would term a pharmacological dose. So, you know, much higher than you would find in nature. You know, at least it's not a synthetic drug. It's a natural thing. But, hey, natural things multiplied 100-fold over what you'd be getting in a diet, you know, we want to use that only where the benefit outweighs whatever potential risk there is of doing something that's not in a normal diet.
I also want to take this opportunity to inform Michelle, because she's taking thyroid replacement for hypothyroidism, what we know recently in the scientific literature, and I've basically been on a soapbox telling anybody taking thyroid replacement, that you have to wait a full hour before you even have your first cup of coffee after taking any thyroid replacement, whether it's Westroid, Armathyroid, Synthroid, Levothyroxine, Cytomel, whichever.
Yeah.
And they found it's not the caffeine, Dr. Hoffman. They've not been able to identify what exactly it is about coffee, but they have been able to assert that it's not the caffeine. So it doesn't matter if it's decaf. People will say to me, oh, but I drink decaf.
Yeah.
But that doesn't matter. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, so here's a possible workaround is that for some of our patients, we tell them, you know, keep the thyroid by the bedside with a glass of water. And
yes.
You know, most people do get up a little bit before they have to get up. You know, and then they get up, they go to the bathroom, they go back to sleep.
Right.
And therefore, you know, it's like they get up at 4
it's
in the morning.
A good opportunity to take it, yeah.
Take a little, you know, with a little bit of water. And then you can, if you have to get to work early and you need to eat, by then it'll be in your system for a couple hours at least.
Right.
Another workaround, and it works pretty well for some people, and it sounds counterintuitive. You know, thyroid is a bit of a stimulant, so you might think taking it at bedtime is a bad idea. But actually, for some people, they feel pretty good taking thyroid at bedtime, and they tolerate it. They don't feel like they have, you know, excitation or arousal from the stimulant effects of the thyroid, and they feel pretty good through the morning. You know, after it's sort of begins to gradually leave the system. So usually people, I mean, it's a good idea to not eat right before bedtime. A lot of people do, but usually people eat dinner and then there's at least a couple of hours before they go to sleep.
You know what I find fascinating amongst many of our hypothyroid patients is that when they are on the right amount of thyroid replacement, which Dr. Hoffman, I have to say, you are so good at doing with them because it's such a delicate dance, that these folks who weren't great sleepers before, before they had their hypothyroid treated properly, suddenly now they're sleeping beautifully.
Yep.
Now, you would think that was counterintuitive because somebody with a sluggish thyroid is going to be tired, fatigued. They may want to be sleeping 10 hours. But that's not the case with
everyone. Sleep quality is often not good. And, you know, I don't know about you, but my sleep is very active. Sometimes I wake up in the morning, I go, whew, that was a rough night. Now I get to go to work and just kind of sit in a chair and relax, you know. Because
you know, sometimes it's the supplements. Sometimes it's the supplements.
Yeah. Well, I'm doing some heavy work and reprocessing and rewiring and, you know, it's a lot going on metabolically. And a lot of healing is going on, too, because I think that's also the time where, you know, if you are heavily into training, your body does a lot of repair at night. So if you are metabolically sluggish, the quality or the depth of your sleep might be lowered. And therefore, when you're metabolically tuned up, you might be able to get into this, what is a very active metabolic state. It's not turning off the light switch. It literally is putting you into an active repair state that's a different form of consciousness than your waking consciousness, but is requires, it's very energy dependent. There's a lot, you know, if you do brain scans, the brain is a very energy dependent organ. The brain is working overtime during sleep.
A lot of the repair process has to do with that, the REM sleep in particular, after the very deep, deep, deep non-dream sleep.
Mm-hmm.
What is that, the Delta 4 or
and also
those waves?
There's something called the glymphatic system, which is the brain's glial lymphatic system, which literally is a brain-washing system that activates during sleep. And in sleep deprivation, your brain literally toxifies with certain waste products that aren't properly cleared. So, you know, gives a new meaning to the term brainwashing.
Wow. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah. And just while I'm at it, here's something, a little tidbit that I picked up. Japanese researchers have just discovered a new solution to nighttime awakening to urinate. And I tell you what, I'll keep our audience in suspense. Inside too, I'll tell you about it. Okay? It's like simple, effective way to reduce nighttime urination. You know, medically referred to as nocturia. And we'll share that with our audience when we return. What's our next question? Give us a preview.
Our next question is about what do you think of Huperzine for memory. And I have a friend who takes it, and when he stops it, he notices a deficiency in his short-term memory.
Wow. Okay. We will tackle that issue when we return. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. And we're taking your questions. Questions come to us via radio program at AOL.com. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, and we'll be right back with part two.